Can you hear me on this? I have my weird, oh, it is working, my weird Britney Spears microphone. Thank you for coming. I can't see all of you, but about 30 plus years ago, I was sitting where you're sitting, only at Traverse City Central. In those days, there was one high school, no rivalry. We just fought with ourselves. I'm going to speak here very briefly. I can't tell you how honored I am that Mr. Brokaw has agreed to come to Traverse City and to talk to you. As I said 30 years ago, I was sitting in a chair much like yours, and in the rare chance back then in the Cretaceous period, back in the 20th century, we would have someone come to Traverse City to talk about the arts and writing. It was a rare, rare experience indeed, and it had a huge impact on my life. It really set the course for me. I've never forgotten those people, those teachers, those writers who've stepped forward and tried to push me or guide me in certain directions. Sit there with open ears. You don't have to take notes. There's no test, but just listen and try to observe, and whatever falls off from this stage into your life, you'll never know. You may reflect on it here next week or next year or in the next decade. Mr. Brokaw is really one of America's, or probably the America's most trusted, empathic, interesting, widely varied storyteller that we have working today. He's done over 25 documentaries in his long career. He's been both the host of the Today Show, Meet the Press, and the NBC Nightly News. His range and his experience is incredible. He's going to come out now and share some of that with you. I know he has something he wants to read to you. He'll speak for 15, 20 minutes, and then do we have any questions for him? Yeah, okay. Listen, please give a huge round of applause for Mr. Tom Brokaw. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Let me just say something at the outset, what a privilege it is to be here in Traverse City, and what a relief it is to be before both West and Central High School audiences, because I realized as I was walking out here, if I were speaking at Marquette, I'd have to speak much more slowly and use much shorter words than I would have to here today. I can't see you because of the big lights out there, but I want to begin by asking all of you a question. Raise your hand if in the last 24 hours you've been on Twitter. How many of you have been on Facebook in the last 24 hours? How many of you in the last hour have texted a friend? How many of you in the last 24 hours have picked up a book that had nothing to do with your schoolwork? It was a novel or something else? That's pretty good. You are part of a very unique development in the history of mankind. You have at your fingertips a transformative technology that people of my generation and Doug's generation and all of your principals, for that matter, never could have anticipated when we were your age. The transformative technology of the Internet and all of its applications that when we stop and think about it, even now, are in a relatively primitive form compared to what they will be 10 years from now. I have been a keen student of information technology from the beginning because I realized it would have a lot to do with the kind of life that I have professionally. So I made a point of getting to know the early pioneers. I went out to Seattle to meet Bill Gates when he was little known. I went to Silicon Valley and met Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and the others who were beginning to develop personal computers and the software that would drive them and the microchips that would become the engines as well. And we knew that there was something out there called the Internet. It had been used primarily for government communication and for education. But when it began to kind of rise up in this world, I went to Bill Gates, for example, and Andy Grove, who was one of the geniuses at Intel, the maker of microchips, and I said, what do you think is the future of the Internet? Not much. Don't think it's going to go anywhere. We think that really the future is in the laptop computer and in the DVDs that we developed to put in that. They were almost as wrong-headed as a man who was running IBM in the early 1980s, and he came to NBC to spend some time with us. Now, IBM in those days was the colossus of American business, and he was talking about the future of that company. And I said to him then, because we had at home small, primitive Mac, an Apple computer that my kids were playing Pong on and writing some school papers and getting access to some information that was coming from Wall Street in those days. I said, what do you think about personal computers? And this man from IBM, the new CEO, said to me, not much. Don't think it's going to last. My wife uses it to write invitations to the country club, but I don't think it has much application. This is all in the last 20 years. And think how rapidly the world has changed, how it has transformed your life, and how it will continue to be an integral part of who you are and whatever you choose to do in your life. You are the first generation, or part of the first generations, to teach their parents how to drive. That's how you have to think about it. Because you're reinventing new forms every day in your use of all this technology and its applications, whether it's Facebook or MySpace or any of the blogs that exist out there. And you're constantly thinking of new ways that it can enhance your life, either socially or even professionally or in your scholastic work. It is a marvel. That's indisputable. But there are some enduring truths about it as well. There are enormous challenges in the world today, in this country today. Your generation must be keenly aware of that too, because while you have been in high school, America has gone through the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression, which you may have heard your grandparents or great-grandparents talk about. There has been a kind of disorientation, if you will, about the expectations for the American economy. Many of you personally may have been witness to this in your own homes. Your parents for the first time worried about retirement or hanging on to a job or wondering about the value of their homes. And this new technology alone can't change that. You cannot alter reality or even get new insights into it by hitting the delete button. You can't change global warming by hitting backspace. You can't rearrange your social life by going to cut and paste and editing your social life. It still takes an active intelligence and a physical and intellectual and emotional commitment to making decisions about your life that count. Moreover, this technology has another characteristic that you have to stop and think about. It has, in my judgment, two enduring truths that are not fully realized. One is that everything that you write to your friends or about your friends, to your parents or about your parents, about something that is happening in the world, it is permanently imprinted. You have a long-standing digital fingerprint that is being accumulated every day, so you have to stop and think about that. You have to realize that everything you put on your BlackBerry or other PDA or on your laptop at some point is retrievable. And it will help identify who you are. It will become, if you will, part of your character. And so you have to stop and think about that as well. The other enduring truth about this technology that is so exciting and is so irresistible it becomes a kind of a narcotic. When was the last time that you were in a public place, a restaurant, or in a sports arena, or in an airport, and didn't see 80% of the people exercising their thumbs? It goes on all day, every day. There's no question about it. But while it has a digital imprint, does what you write have any enduring value? Does it linger as a truth or an insight that can be shared by other people? In 99.9% of the circumstances, it does not. And that's why tweet is a verb, but writing is forever. Because over the long history of mankind, from the time that cavemen began to use charcoal sharpened sticks to write on cave walls and leave pictographs behind in Africa or even in the American West or in the Middle East, or began to write crudely on papyrus when paper was first invented, that has endured. And that has given us insights into the human condition of that time and long-standing truths that still help guide us today. So the printed word, I believe, will not and ought not to go away, because it is that enduring character of the printed word. And it may be electronic in some fashion, but it will be there in more than a shorthand for a long, long time. Those will be the compass points for our lives. Those will be the insights that we'll all depend on. I have brought with me just a few examples that have touched my own life. Let me take 2 minutes and tell you about my own personal experience with writing. When I was a young man coming of age, I thought I'd like to write, but I really didn't have the courage to do it, nor the patience to sit down and work at it as hard as I needed to. I thought I detected a certain innate skill, if you will, to be able to express myself both on the written page, but also verbally. It was easier to do it verbally. And besides, there was something new called television news coming along, and I wanted to be involved in that, and so I raced off to work at that. But I never lost the appetite for wanting to write something at some point. And so early in my television career, I began tentatively at first, and then more vigorously, to write first magazine articles about politics or personal experiences, and then commentaries in the New York Times or in the New Yorker or the Washington Post or the Los Angeles Times, and then longer magazine articles, and then finally I began to write a book called The Greatest Generation, and I've been writing more actively ever since then, and it is the most gratifying thing that I do in so many ways. Television, at the end of the day, is a cheap thrill. I've been on television to last a lifetime, or four lifetimes. I love it. I think it's an important medium. But nothing gives me the satisfaction of picking up one of my own books, reading something that I've written, and thinking, not bad. I could have done a lot better there. That doesn't hold up, but this has continuing insight. And what I learned about writing is that, like anything else in life, you can't do it just randomly. You have to work at it very hard. Peter Benchley, a remarkable young man who wrote a book that later became one of the best-selling films of all time. It was called Jaws. Peter Benchley was the grandson of a famous American essayist. And his grandfather, when Peter was 16 or 17, and went to talk to his grandfather about getting a summer job, his grandfather said, "Do you want to be a writer, Peter?" And he said, "Do." He said, "Okay, I'm going to pay you to be a writer. Instead of mowing lawns or working at the grocery store, sacking groceries, I'm going to pay you a modest fee to stay at home all day, every day, during the summer, and write." And that's how Peter became a writer. And when we talked about that at the time, I thought, it's absolutely correct. Really great writers write all the time. If they're not sitting at a desk, they're writing in their own mind. They're constantly thinking about the shape of a sentence or the outlines of a story that they want to tell. And in my case, that turned out to be very helpful to me as well. The more I wrote, the better, more I liked it, the better I became at it. So I thought I would share with you today some language that didn't come off a Twitter account, that you can't find on a Facebook, that is not part of a blog, except as it has been retrieved and aggregated, which is one of the phrases that we now use with this new technology. I thought I would begin with the opening paragraph of a book that I cherish, because it might have some application to those of you who live in this area where the outdoors are so important and where fly fishing is a central part of the attraction of Traverse City and the Great Bay Area. It was a book written by Norman McLean, who grew up in Montana and then went to Northwestern, where he was an English major, and he wrote a book that became a film called A River Runs Through It. It was the first real starring vehicle for a young actor by the name of Brad Pitt. Some of you may have seen it. This is his opening paragraph. "In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John, the favorite, was a dry fly fisherman." I think that's a magnificent piece of prose. It will last forever. And when you read it, even if you're not a fly fisherman, you're likely to pause at the end of that paragraph and look off into the distance and think, "My God, that will linger with me for a long, long time." I then decided I would go find some other sentences that I liked and passages. "Your fellow Michigander, Ernest Hemingway, had a few rules about writing. Keep the sentences short, keep the opening paragraph short, use vigorous language, and then his fourth rule, don't ever follow just four rules. If you're looking for a book about writing, there are many of them. I think that there is no more enchanting, inspirational book than Hemingway's book called A Movable Feast, about his days in Paris in the 1920s, when his objective in his year as a Bohemian writer, having left the continental United States to move to Paris to become a writer and becoming, if you will, one of the legendary writers of the American canon of literature. His goal, his first year, was to write five good sentences." So I've always kept that in mind over the years about what writers ought to have as an objective, because those five good sentences can lead to five more, lead to 20 more, and to 200 more, 2,000 more, and 20,000 more. And that's how you build writing. This country's at war, as you know. It's in war in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And the man who introduced me, Doug Stanton, has written a remarkably exciting book called The Horse Soldiers, about the special forces that first went into Afghanistan, about their assignment. He's done it in vivid detail, and it's an enormously important insight into the challenges that face us there and continue to face us. War has always been an inspiration for writers because, if you will, of the emotions that it touches and the dangers that it presents and the risks that are inherent in war and the price of war, survive or die. Let me read to you another passage that would not have come off Facebook or Twitter. This is about a group of Englishmen who had invaded France, and they were trying to get back to England. And they were cut off by a much superior French force. And their commander gathered them the night before the great battle. And this is what he said to them. We happy few, we band of brothers, for he who today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile this day, shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England back home, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhood cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. You've all heard the phrase, the band of brothers. This is the first time that it was written on a page. It was written by a little-known writer by the name of William Shakespeare in 1599, more than 100 years after the Battle at Agincourt. He was imagining what King Henry V might have been saying to his followers because they went on to triumph against the vastly superior, in terms of manpower, French force. And that phrase, a band of brothers, has been forevermore associated not just with combat, but with great challenges, with people having to band together and making a commitment to a cause greater than their collective few or even their own lives. Some of you probably are familiar with the HBO film, A Band of Brothers, produced by Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, about one squadron during World War II. Well, for all their originality, it was not Steven and Tom Hanks who came up with that phrase. It was William Shakespeare. Here are some other opening lines. From Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie. The opening line, all children except one grow up. Who would not be intrigued about what was to follow that line if you were to pick up a book called Peter Pan? The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. As Gregor Samsa awoke from a night of uneasy dreaming, he found himself transformed in his bed into a gigantic insect. Moby Dick by Herman Melville. A classic opening line. Call me Ishmael. 1984, some of you in this auditorium probably have read that book by George Orwell. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. He was writing about a changed world. One of my particular favorites is a book called The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. because I am a product of parents of the Great Depression. My mother and father grew up in the Great Plains when the winds came and dried the earth and blew away their hopes and their homesteads and their farms. It was a time of great migration from Oklahoma to California, from Kansas to Seattle. In our case, from South Dakota, many of our relatives went to Seattle to work in the aerospace industry. In The Grapes of Wrath, in the opening lines, John Steinbeck wrote, "To the red country and part of the gray country of Oklahoma, the last rains came gently, and they did not cut the scarred earth." In that simple line, he gives you the prologue for all that is to follow. My point, quite simply, is that words endure if they have meaning and if they address something larger than yourself or larger than your need to communicate with one another about some triviality in your life or even something as important as who's going to take you to the prom or who you're trying to avoid going to the prom with. And words will give you an emotional and intellectual satisfaction for the rest of your lives that will be ever be as important to you as having the right kind of nutritional diet in your lives. So my conclusion is that what you must do every day in some fashion is to think about where you are and where you want to go or where you'd like your country to go or your community and write that down. Not on an electronic journal, but on a piece of paper using pen and ink so that it will endure in some form. I wrote a book called The Greatest Generation about the people who went off to war in the Pacific and across the Atlantic. And the most remarkable tales that came out of all my research were not from the history departments of Harvard or Yale or from the archives of the Pentagon. The most remarkable archives that I found were in love letters and in diaries that were sent home by men in battle or by their wives to them in distant places. And I promise you that you can do this. When I was your age and coming out of high school, immodestly, I was a whiz kid. I'd gotten all the honors that you could possibly hope for in my home state of South Dakota. I was governor of Boys State. I was president of my class. I was a three-sport athlete. My destiny seemed to be only greatness. And I went off to the University of Iowa and immediately crashed and burned for the next 9 months. I thought beer was food. I took some history classes, but the dates I were really interested in came from Sorority Row. I thought I could get by on easy charm, and that just by showing up, people would give me a pass. And it was a big reality check. So I retreated to South Dakota to repair myself, and failed again, a second time, because I was in pursuit of sybaritic joy. And I quickly learned that you can be the life of the party the night before, it doesn't do you much good the morning after. But I was stuck in a bad place, delusional, thinking I'll work my way out of this at any time, when some friends intervened. Because it turns out that my parents and my friends and my school teachers were all puzzled, befuddled, bewildered, and increasingly angry about how I was leading this life of misdirection. And so they confronted me. And it was a wake-up call. And I managed to pull myself together. And I went back to school, because by then I had dropped out, got my grades repaired, got my degree, and the first friend who intervened. I was so grateful to her. We got married. And we have been for 47 years. But I have warned... But I have worn that failure at that critical time in my life every day, metaphorically, like one of those ankle bracelets that people who get out of prison and are confined to homestay have to wear. I drag it around with me. I failed. I had a great chance to do something well when I was 18 and 19 and 20, and I didn't do it. It's a very helpful reminder to me about life having both its uptimes and its downsides, and how quickly the upside can turn to a downside. And so everything I've done since then, I've been trying to make up for those failures and that time, but it was very helpful to me because it gave me new insights into what it takes to have real accomplishment in life, to leave something that you can be proud of, that is enduring, that life is not a popularity contest. Life that you're proud of at any stage really depends on the marks that you leave behind. And the best marks that you can leave behind are between the hardcovers of a book, that are the lessons that others should know about. Small, large, and for the long haul. So I wish you all the very best in what I know will be a prize-winning writing career. And even if you're not published by one of the major houses, you'll get enormous satisfaction out of putting down your thoughts that go beyond your immediate needs and reflecting on life around you and keeping them so that you can read them 20 years from now or 30 years from now and share them with your children and your grandchildren. Unfortunately, during that time when I was going off the rails, some of my many girlfriends kept the letters that I wrote to them. And a few of them have been sending them to me. And I don't know whether to burn them or to put them up on the wall and read them every day to have humility forced upon me to know how completely off the tracks that I was. So I wish you the very best, and I'll conclude by reading something that I wrote, because I'm circling back now to what is important in writing. You write about what you care about, what you're passionate about, and what you love, and what you know. I'm a bird hunter. I have Labrador dogs. I'm now down to one, but I've had as many as three. When our children left home for college, my wife and I decided that we would go back to having dogs again. And we very quickly became the kind of people that we used to make fun of. Our lives revolve around our dogs. We talk to them as if they are going to talk back to us at any moment now. One of our friends pointed out that when we had two dogs, Abby and Sage, who were great bird dogs, and we had an enormous affection for both of them, they would always be on our Christmas card. Then we had our first grandchild, and all of our friends wondered who would be on the Christmas card, the dogs or the grandchildren. We worked it out. The dogs were on the front, the grandchildren were inside. I've just written an article called Last Dance for My Ladies. These are about two dogs, Sage and Abby, who were phenomenal dogs in the field, flushing pheasants and grouse and partridge, and retrieving them. Sage was one in a million, the kind of dog you get only once in 12 lifetimes. And she was the first to go. and it was a heartbreaking time for us. But we put her down in Montana and buried her on a hillside in a grove of aspen overlooking a stream where she used to go fly fishing with me every day, where we know the wolves come through in the wintertime, and where there are Hungarian partridge around and sharp-tailed grouse to keep her company. And so we had Abby left, a tiny, black, muscular lab who we'd gotten in Scotland, who had always had to play second fiddle to Sage, but Abby began to break down as well, and we knew that Abby's days were numbered. 2 years ago in Montana, we had now a third dog, a boy, Red, a yellow lab who was a great field dog, and Red and I were getting ready to go out to go hunting on a cool day in the fall. And as I got the shotgun out of the gun safe and put on my vest and my bright orange cap, Abby pulled herself down off her sleeping pad, came over to me in her arthritic legs and began to waggle her tail and looked at me plaintively as if to say, I need to go as well. So I looked at her and I said, okay, Abby, you get to go. She waggled all the way to the four-wheeler where I lifted her in beside me and drove to a tall stand of blue-stem grass and timothy bordered by choke cherry bushes leading to a sharp incline. Red was bouncing through the vegetation onto something, just what I didn't know, as Abby followed me through the high grass. Suddenly, Red put up a covey of blue grouse and a separate covey of ruff grouse simultaneously. I shot and killed a ruffed and winged a blue at the top of that steep ridgeline. Red went after the dead bird, and I said to Abby, okay, old girl, we have to go find the other. It was hard work. It had gotten warm, and so the hike was hot. We went straight uphill. And when I reached the top, I looked around, and Abby was missing. My God, I thought, she's died of a stroke or a heart attack. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a black ball of fur tumbling down from the top of the hill, pushing a wounded grouse ahead with her nose. Abby, her legs now worn out, was sliding and rolling the bird into the bushes where she could trap it against the thick roots. When she reached the bushes, she grabbed that blue grouse in her jaws and lay down, exhausted, waiting for me to retrieve them both. I pocketed the grouse, picked up Abby, and carried her down the hill, weeping softly as I kept repeating into her ear, good girl, good girl. That's something I wrote for myself. That is something I wrote for myself. It's been picked up in a book and then published in a magazine this month. And I'm flattered that other people are reading it and are moved by it. But the fact is, if only my wife and I had seen what I wrote, it would keep Abby and Sage alive in our hearts forever. And that's one more reward of writing. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Can we turn on the house lights? Can we turn on the house lights so I can see everybody?
Erica, can we have the house lights on, please? We have time for a few questions, and we have microphones at either end of this center aisle, so if you'd like to come down, Mr. Brokaw will take a couple of your questions.
If you don't have any questions, if you have answers, I'd be very grateful for that. Let me ask a question of how many of you have read a printed newspaper in the last 24 hours? That's pretty good. How many of your parents have read a printed newspaper in the last 24 hours? How many of you watched an evening newscast on one of the networks? See, Traverse City is a superior society.
There we go. We have a question right over here.
Question.
Who's the most interesting person you've ever interviewed that you most enjoyed?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Who's the most interesting person you've ever interviewed?
Oh, I'm often asked that. And, you know, I've had great opportunities over the years to interview everybody from the Kennedys to Dr. King, Margaret Thatcher to Ronald Reagan to Mikhail Gorbachev. I had the first interview ever with the leader of the Soviet Union. I was with Nelson Mandela the day that he was released from prison in South Africa. I can call Michael Jordan a friend, Bruce Springsteen. I've met lots of people over the years and a wide variety of enterprises that are luminaries of our time. The fact is, the people who have made the greatest impression on me are people whose names I don't know, and I've met them randomly. Very brave civil rights workers in the South. One night in Americus, Georgia, when the town was ready to go up, and the African-American population was deciding whether they were going to march for their rights that night or the next day, and the streets were lined with pickup trucks with pickaxes in the back and men armed with shotgun threatening to kill anybody who did march. And about midnight, a meeting of the black community broke up at a little church on the edge of town. And this beautiful young woman, about your age, came out of the church first. And she had a look of great fear on her face. And I said, "What have you decided?" And she said, "We're going to march." And I said, "My God, aren't you frightened?" And she said, "I'm terrified." And I said, "Well, why are you going to march?" She said, "We have no other choice." And she walked down the steps and marched, and the others marched with her. And this country was transformed by acts of courage like that. Not just for African-American people, but for all of us. We were liberated from the shackles of segregation and racism. I was in Somalia, which is the worst place I've ever been in the world. It's a definition of anarchy. It's, as you know, over the eastern shore of Africa. They've had a civil war going on for 30 years. I was in a remote place where Doctors Without Borders, the international medical community, had tents set up, lit by kerosene lanterns, mortar rounds falling all around us. There was a young Oklahoma surgeon in there trying to save the life of a young Somali girl who had been wounded by shrapnel. It was a very dangerous place to be, and I said to him, "Why have you decided to do this?" And he said, "Oh, God, I don't know, Mr. Broker. I'm the first member of my family to go to college, and I got this medical school education. And I thought, God gave me all these skills. I've got to give something back for a while. I'll go back to Tulsa at some point and replace knees and hips and make a lot of money. But in the meantime, there's no other place that I would rather be." I've had those kinds of experiences all over the world throughout my entire career. Young warriors in uniform, young peace activists, people who were acting out of the convictions of their hearts and their minds, not asking for any recognition whatsoever except the satisfaction of doing the right thing for mankind. And those are the people, quite honestly, who have made the most lasting impression on me over the years.
Thank you. We have a question over there on the left.
So when you start your writing process...
You have to step right up to the microphone.
So when you start your writing process, how do you know where to start?
When you start your writing process, where do you know how to start? She asked.
Well, Joan Didion has a great line. A lot of you won't know who Joan Didion is, but Doug will. Joan Didion is a very gifted American novelist, a woman who wrote the best book about California in the 60s and 70s called Play It As It Lays. Joan Didion has this phrase that she has two rules about writing. One is about grammar. She says, "I seem to have been out of school the year the rules were mentioned. Grammar is a piano that I play by ear." And I've been intrigued by novelists, especially in how they write. And I said to Joan, who I find to be a very imaginative novelist, when you sit down in the morning, now at your laptop, but in the old days as your typewriter with a blank sheet of paper, do you know where you're going? And she said, no, I don't. I have a kind of vague idea, but I leap off the page and start writing. And the writing takes me to where I need to get to. And that's how it happens. I didn't have the courage to be a writer for a long time. I was a little concerned that people would mock my writing. I was a television correspondent. In those days, there was a wide gap between television and people who were in print journalism. But I'd earned my stripes as a television journalist, and I had a lot of friends on the print side. So I decided I would take a chance at it. And the first big piece that I wrote was for the Los Angeles Times Magazine. I was in a terrible river running accident in 1972 in Idaho on the Middle Fork of the Salmon. I lost a very dear friend, and one of the guides was killed as well. And when I got back to Los Angeles, the editor of the Los Angeles Times called and said, we'd like you to write that for the magazine. I had a pretty substantial reputation as a television journalist, and one of the questions I had to ask myself, if I don't do this well, will people mock me and think less of me? So I have to do it well. And I wrote it. And it turned out to be the perfect kind of an assignment. It was the outdoors. It was a deeply personal experience. It was surfeited with tragedy, and it was a haunting story in the end. So I wrote it. And it was published in the Los Angeles Times, and it got an enormous amount of attention in California. And in many, many ways, in ways I could not have anticipated, it lifted me, especially in the eyes of my colleagues in print. And that was a breakthrough for me. And then I thought, you know, maybe I can do this. And nothing now gives me more satisfaction than writing. I spent part of the morning working on a new book here. And after a couple of hours of working on my laptop and doing some research and rearranging some things, it was an utterly satisfying morning. I enjoyed it a lot. And I felt that it was worthwhile, that I had done something that had meaning for me, and I hope downstream it will have meaning for people who will pick up this book and read it.
We have one over here on the right. Step right up to the mic.
Hi. I was wondering how you felt about media bias and if you have noticed any shift in how the news is reported throughout your career.
About
any feelings about media bias and any and what's
oh,
does it
bias.
Exist? How do you?
Yeah,
what's your take?
I get this asked a lot. You're living in a much different time. Doug's a lot younger than I am, but even when Doug was growing up, you didn't have that many choices. You could be a couch potato. The newspaper would arrive on your front porch, and you'd pick it up and read it, or you'd wait for 5:30 at night to watch Walter Cronkite, or Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, or later Tom, Peter, and Dan. And those were the choices that you had. Now, in your age group, the spectrum of choices is beyond wide and divided up into many, many parts. So when you say media bias, it's kind of hard to know what part of the media are we talking about here, because there are so many parts to it. Mainstream journalism, New York Times, The Washington Post, NBC News, ABC News, CBS News. We work very, very hard at finding the facts as they exist and putting them in some kind of context. It would do us little good to try to load up a newscast with our bias, because you would quickly find it out, and you would turn away from us. We're not in the business of driving viewers away. Now, because the spectrum is so crowded, there are places where you can go to get, and I wouldn't call it bias, you can get point of view. Fox News is a perfect example of that. They fill the void in American life. And when the sun goes down, the Fox commentators let you know what they think in no uncertain terms. There's a little more of what they think during the day than I'd like to see, but I can't knock it because I believe in free press. MSNBC during the day tells you what happened. At sundown, you get Chris Matthews, Rachel Maddow, and Keith Olbermann telling you what they think. And as a viewer or as a reader, you have to be much more proactive. You can't be a couch potato anymore. You have to decide for yourself Do I believe that person? Where is that information coming from? Let me apply certain tests to it, whether to see whether it holds up or not, whether it has integrity or credibility over the long haul. And for people who complain about the clatter on cable television, I often say to them, gosh, I've got something at home you may not have. It's called a remote control. It's got an on button and an off button, or a channel changer. So you're not hostage to what you're hearing, but you have to bring an active intelligence to what's out there. You can't be just a benign consumer of the news anymore.
Last question over here on the left.
What are some of the things you find inspiration in for your writing?
Is your question, what do you find inspirational for your writing? Is that correct? Okay.
What's the question?
What's inspirational to you in your writing?
What's inspirational to me in my writing are something I talked about just a moment ago. Are people who have the everyday courage to take on big challenges in their personal life or in their community or in their state or in their nation, and to apply that courage to the solution of big problems for the benefit of us all. The best perfect example of that in my career really were the civil rights workers. Nothing changed America as profoundly as the civil rights movement in the 1960s, led by Dr. King, who had a philosophy of nonviolence and believed in the rule of law. When I was in the South and go into these towns where there would be confrontations between black citizens who wanted simply the right to vote without being put through SAT-type tests, or the right to have access to any public facility, water fountains, restrooms, motels, public transportation. And when they would arrive in a town to make their case, they would march through the town with dignity, quietly. And then when they were attacked by the law enforcement officers of the South, they would go down and cover themselves up and take the beatings of the batons and get up and walk again and not fight back or shoot back. That had an enormous impact on the rest of this country as it witnessed it every night on television, because it created what I later described as a moral epiphany. We could not, to ourselves or to the world, say that we are the most just society that ever existed, with the kind of racial discrimination that we had at that time. And we learned so much from it. I'll just give you one quick personal experience. 2 weeks ago, I was lecturing at Ole Miss in Oxford, Mississippi, the University of Mississippi. It was the worst institution in the South when I was a reporter. It was where James Meredith, a native-born Mississippian, veteran of the Air Force, tried to enroll at the state university. And there were violent protests and gunshots and clubs, and a journalist was killed. And the federal government had to send in the 101st Airborne to make sure that he was enrolled and to protect him as he went to class. And it bitterly, deeply divided that state. Now I go back to Ole Miss, and there's a statue on campus of James Meredith walking through a porthole that is labeled Courage. All the classes are integrated. The president of the Ole Miss Alumni Association is an African-American woman from Mississippi. A lot of you saw Blindside, the story of Michael Orr. He went to Ole Miss. He was one of the most popular figures on campus. When I was teaching there, and then brought in some friends who had been involved in covering the civil rights movement, one of them paused, looked out into the integrated audience of students and said, you have to understand, when we were reporters in the South, this would have been an illegal gathering. So that movement and those people really liberated all of us. And over the years, I've written a lot about race because that happened to inspire me. Thank you again.
All right, thank you. Go ahead.